Hello. I'm here to tell you about a very special activity, a one-of-a-kind activity for Pesca Plus subscribers. We are having a book club. The first book in our book club is called Hope for Cynics, The Surprising Science of Human Goodness. It's by Jamil Zaki, who's been on the show, and he will be there at the book club, but it is only for Pesca Plus subscribers. The date is February 18th. The time is 8 to 9:30 Eastern Time. And if you go to subscribe.mikepesca.com, you can subscribe for an ad-free version if you want, or go all the way to Pesca Plus and be invited to our first ever book club. There's a lot of other fantastic activities that we have for our Pesca Plus subscribers. To find out more information about all of this, sign up for our newsletter. It will all be coming out about our February 18th inaugural book club, Hope for Cynics with Jamil Zaki. It's Thursday, February 13th, 2025, from Peachfish Productions. It's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. Yesterday, President Trump in the Oval Office mused about a phone call he had with Vladimir Putin. "We're going to have a peace plan," President Trump said. "Russia has suffered millions of losses," President Trump said, greatly inflating the figure and sympathizing with the bad guys. "It's all, of course, going to be great." Unlike the Gaza peace plan, this peace plan can actually happen. That's because in Gaza, the president's plan is to clear out our enemies, and our enemies will oppose that. Plan hard. In Ukraine, the president has mistaken who our enemies are. He is going to reward our enemies. That peace plan is easy. You can sign just about any deal if you give your rival what your rival wants and act against your own side's self-interest. Anyway, some in the administration and many who voted for Trump do not think that helping Ukraine and opposing Putin is in the United States' self-interest. They're wrong. Now, I don't think Trump is exactly necessarily acting in Putin's interest because it's Putin's interest. That would have been the narrative if this happened in the Trump 45 administration. The more accurate way to think of it is not as Trump, as Putin puppet, more like he's Russia agnostic. But he's also strategically wrong about that. And then Russia was asked, "Okay, you and Putin, you got a deal that's brewing." Trump mentioned Biden. He's by implication somehow rebuffed by this deal. "But there's someone you're not talking about. Listen hard to this question.
Do you view Ukraine as an equal member of this peace process?"
It's an interesting question.
No, it's actually not interesting. If the answer were, as it definitely should have been, "Yes, of course the Ukrainians are equal members of the peace process, the process of peace between Russia and Ukraine." Yes, if the answer were yes, then it becomes not an interesting question. It's only interesting because the answer was...
I think they have to make peace. Their people are being killed, and I think they have to make peace. I said that was not a good war to go into, and I think they have to make peace. That's what I think.
Well, the U.S. is Ukraine's major backer, so if he says it, it becomes true, or close to true. It becomes true that we stop supporting the democratically elected country that is our ally, and we start supporting the autocratic country that aggresses against our allies. Now, I guess we're achieving something interesting. Fantastic. Of course, Ukraine does currently control territory that was Russia 3 months ago. They're not going to give it up easily. They're dug in, and they don't need too many advanced weapons to hold it. This forced upon a certain party peace process will perhaps be a little less clean and a little more interesting than President Trump and Vladimir Putin would like. On the show today, I shall spiel about the confirmation of a few cabinet secretaries. And no, I don't mean agriculture. But first, Chuck D was the front man of Public Enemies in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. He's an artist, and I don't just mean recording. He's here to talk about his series of sketches and his diary, Interfacial Artelligence, The Moments That Met Me, me being Chuck D, up next.
Nineteen.
Chuck D, the leader of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inducted Public Enemy, is a member of the rock supergroup Prophets of Rage. He is an artist. He is a diarist. I've read a few of his books. His new one is called, and this is, I'm not mispronouncing it, Interstitial Artelligence. See what he did there. Hey, Chuck D, welcome to The Gist. Thanks for coming on.
Good to be here, Mike. Thank you.
What does visual art do for you?
It's expression. It's damn near like therapy. They say, you know, a picture is worth a thousand words. So I think in this day and time with so much going on around us, sometimes rather than talk it out, you know, I do an illustration, do it very quick. It's a little takeoff from back in the newspaper days where there was a daily political cartoon. And I would just get the point across real quick about what I thought. And that's what it means to me. It's like, boom, get it out and let people go come to their own interpretation. They're going to ask you anyway, even if you put it in words, because I'm cryptic, Mike. Mm-hmm. And I use the Bill Russell quote a lot. Bill Russell, the great center for the Boston Celtics. It's easier to understand than to be understood. So lately I just been able to just the last couple of years through the uses of social media, where you're able to get that immediate response, put up something, an image, do it in Al Hirschfeld type speed and line, and get the point across. And it saves me from using a lot of words like I'm doing answering that long ass with my long ass answer for your short question.
Do you hide the word Nina or some version of it in your drawings? Did I miss that?
No, not yet.
Not that level of Hirschfeld.
No, I really want to be, you know, each illustration that I've done, and I've done over like 50,000 since 2016. I'm lazy because I'm really supposed to be a small PE target. Do it afterwards, but it'd be good to start to do it alongside when I finish the work that minute or that day.
You have always been oriented towards the visual, and if people remember Public Enemy from back in the day, there were the S1Ws, Security of the First World, with those fake machine guns on the stage, and of course the clocks and the branding and the P. That was important to you, so it doesn't surprise me that you have a visual orientation to this day.
Yeah, we had to do that because we wasn't going to get, you know, any video played on MTV. Number one, we wasn't going to get any video made in 1987 and 1988 because our budgets couldn't match up with what had to be required for visual, motion visual appearance. So. Imagery, just like you're reading a comic book, the illustrations are so important. So the imagery was very important. So you could look at it and then bask in your own mind what we tried to convey and get across. So that was the key to Public Enemy, that it was very visual so it could start to work on your imagination. Because, I mean, really back then, all the record was like an audio file coming through, you know, a lot of words and music, and you didn't get the visuals weren't going to be something that you was going to have alongside the words and music. Not then.
But hip hop was always very visual. Maybe, I mean, every genre, right, has imagery associated with it. But hip hop always seemed to me to be all encompassing of all the arts. So dance was an important part, and the visual was an important part, and graffiti. And it wasn't ancillary. It was as much a part of hip hop as what you were doing or what your DJ was doing.
Yeah, Michael, what music is today is sight, sound, story, and style. And those four components make up, you know, the what we call music today, where back in that 80s and 70s and before that, music was something that you heard. It wasn't something that you saw. It could have been something that you experienced or danced to, but the style and the story and the music was something that was on the outside. It wasn't embedded into it necessarily. So when people went out to get music in the 40s, 50s, before that, 60s, 70s, you went out to pick up an audio file, and then you had to use your imagination. And it helped if you was able to have somebody come across and invite you to their TV show where you could perform that song, Hullabaloo, or American Bandstand, or in our cases, Soul Train.
So early on, I've heard you talk about your musical influences and Melly Mel and Grandmaster Flash, but what about your visual influences, maybe even your musical visual influences? What acts did you look at and say, that's either the way I want to look or what they're doing is something I want to emulate?
Well, my eyes were always open because I've been sort of like wanting to be an illustrator ever since I was like 2 years old. I don't know, it might have been in the genes. It might have been encouraged. My grandfather liked to draw a lot. And my great-grandfather, who I never met, who died in 1923, he was like the first licensed, the second licensed black architect in New Jersey. And he, it's reputed that he helped design, many churches in New York, and even was on the...
This was George Washington Foster,
yeah,
was his name.
Yeah, so I mean... But it was like, it was folklore. It wasn't nothing you could look up, you know what I'm saying? Like today, you could look up. Back then, it was like told to you, and it was a fleeting moment, especially growing up. So, my eyes were always open. In the 60s was an exciting time to be a comic book fan, because as Marvel was finding their stride with, their superheroes, Hulk, Spider-Man, who lived in New York City, coincidentally, Submariner, Thor, Captain America, it was a good time to go pick up a comic book and read it, which helped my reading, but also a lot of kids around me also wanted to emulate making comic books. So I think that went hand in hand easy. I didn't have the discipline to keep on doing comic books, but I liked to draw a lot all the time. It was expression. And so later on, just when I got into music, which was as a teenager, only because of hip hop, I put two and two together. My art interests, acumen, and I combined it with music, and then hip hop started. So then doing flyers in Long Island became my first foray into my works being seen by more than one person via printing.
And Public Enemy was like one of those great comic book teams, right? Fantastic Four, The Avenger. It wasn't just you as a solo artist. There was Flavor Flav, mm-hmm. and there was Terminator X. Tell me about the clock. Was that a Flavor Flav thing? Did he invent that or take that from someone, the huge clock?
Well, Mike, in 1986, a lot of kids were wearing clocks at that time. We used to throw a lot of parties and events. We helmed the radio station WBAU for many years, for about a 4 or 5 year period up to then, in Spectrum City, which was the mobile DJ unit that myself and a lot of things surrounded, as well as Dr. Dre, Andre Brown's original concept, which was called The Concept, and we were called Spectrum. We do a lot of events for kids in, Hempstead and Roosevelt and Rockville Center, Freeport, all the Westbury, all the Nassau County.
Baldwin,
kids.
My hometown, Baldwin. Were you in Baldwin?
Baldwin's part of the whole Uniondale, Roosevelt, Oceanside, right. Long Beach, a combination. We did a lot of parties in Long Beach. So with that, we imagery was able to, work through the flyers, and the clocks was something that Sports Illustrated had Sports Illustrated were giving away, like for subscription, they would give away these little stopwatches. And at that time, kids couldn't afford the gold chains, and it wasn't healthy to have a gold chain, and because you get jumped or snatched. So kids, they make up their own styles. And this particular year, 1986, they were wearing the Sports Illustrated stopwatches, you know? So they wear the watches around their neck and style it, and that became a style. And so we wore those in our first photos. And then one day, one of the artists later on to be named Son of Berserk came in from a store that you might be familiar with, a store in Westbury called Fortunoffs. And Fortunoffs had these,
I think my parents just sold their dinette set they got there in 1972.
Exactly. Long Island store. And they were selling these bath clocks. And these bath clocks were, you know what time it is when you're taking a shower or whatever, and you can hang it in the bath. It was waterproof. And he brought one in, and I looked at it, and Flavor looked at it. And I said, that's good. Well, they look like little gold ropes, but there wasn't gold ropes. There was real ropes with a clock. And we both decided to wear the clocks to let people know what time it is. Because that was a saying for, saying, hey, listen, are you aware of what's going on? Do you know what's happening? Right. Are you hip? This is what.
Well, that was my question. What came first, the clocks or the phrase or even the song? What's the time? It's time to get ill.
The saying came, and the style, I guess, rolled along with it. So,
right.
Yeah.
And then because of Sports Illustrated putting out these clocks, are you telling me if it was a few years later, you'd have been wearing sneaker phones around your neck?
No. It had to make sense. It had to be cool. And, Long Island kids are cool. And they made up, they came from all boroughs, their background. So you wasn't corny being on Long Island because you would get checked very quickly. A Brooklyn thing remained a Brooklyn thing. A Bronx thing was a Bronx thing. A Harlem thing was a Harlem thing. Queens thing was a Queens thing. But a Long Island thing was all of the above.
Did you name it Strong Island? Was that you?
Strong Island, the moniker came from answering phones, which was a thing to get dedications up at WBAU. And on the Mr. Bill show, somebody named Nick.
Yeah, this 90.3. This is the Adelphi radio station.
Yes, WBAU. That no longer exists. Yeah, yeah. And I know the phone number, 516-747-4757. But,
so good.
The bottom line on that, this guy called up one of the dedication. He says, I want to hear da-da-da-da-da song, whatever it was. And I said, okay, what's your name? Nick from Strong Island. And once he told me that, I wrote it down and kept it. So whoever Nick is, that day he called in asking for that record and said he was from Strong Island. That's the first time I heard it. And then most people heard it from me using it on records.
Did you think of it as, you were a diarist back then. So did you think of it as a potential lyric? Is that the kind of writer you were, just writing down scraps for future ideas?
Yeah, I was always writing next to an illustration or something like that. But it wasn't never, I'm writing a full song, because what am I writing a full song for? The songs that later on that I did for WBAU, they were radio station promos, because we wanted to be radio jocks. We wanted to do syndicated radio for hip-hop and rap and really treat and curate hip-hop and rap music right. So I had no aspirations to be a recording artist, although I could. But, what thrill is it to be a recording artist when your job is to take, 25 records a week and try to, making one record. I got 25 records this week. I mean, records were a task to take and file and play and figure out where to fit in. So one record was no big deal unless we were able to come with a real serious world of our own. And that's how that started.
I know some of your earlier lyrics, you talk about how the radio was scared of you, and that was definitely true. If it wasn't your student radio station, you were just talking about how MTV wouldn't play you. Hurt?
When we used us, it's like we basically said what they're afraid of is dealing with rap music, right? You know what I'm saying? So it wasn't necessarily us. It was like, you don't want to play rap music. So later on, it's funny, Mike, I'll say this briefly, like we boycotted the Grammys because they didn't have a rap category. So when we said, who give an F about a goddamn Grammy? It was because they didn't care about the rap category. And when Will Smith, when Jazzy Jeff and Fresh Prince won, you know, the gloves were off because, you know, you guys finally acknowledged our genre. So a lot of things we said were basically beating up the opposition, not per se for us, but for the thing that we was enveloped by.
Do you think that track moved the Grammys at all? Do you think it had an effect on the Grammys?
No.
No.
Terminator.
Well, you're supposed
Terminator
to say.
Terminator X to the Edge of Panic. Yeah. We said it. We think people and aficionados of us understood it. But I think it was just a combination of a whole bunch of movements and efforts that made the Grammys understand that we were all coming. Yeah.
Well, that's Chuck D, or some of Chuck D. We're going to have part two tomorrow. And once again, back will be the incredible rhyme animal, Chuck D. Stay tuned for that. You want styling? You know it's time again. D, the enemy, telling you to hear it. They praise the music. It's time to play the lyrics. Some say no to the album, the show. Bum rush the sound. And now the spiel. RFK confirmed, Tulsi confirmed, and sworn in, RFK Jr. on the path to confirmation with only Mitch McConnell voting against him. Kash Patel looks like he'll be confirmed. He's advanced out of committee. For each of them, there are risks to the country. But I think for Gabbard and especially RFK, there are risks to the senators who voted for them. Cash is a little bit of a different case. His primary motivation is, well, I'll read from the New York Times. Republican lawmakers have embraced the choice of Mr. Patel, arguing that the FBI treated conservatives unfairly during the Biden administration. All right, well, now it's not the Biden administration. Yes, yes, I know. Government gangsters, that's the name of Patel's book, and the deep state, et cetera, et cetera. But FBI agents, they're not leftists. They're not inherently anti-conservative. They are what you would call, or what you would have called a couple years ago, conservative. So after 2 weeks where the new sheriff asserts himself and the deputies all get the message, okay, we're no longer encouraged to prosecute Donald Trump. What's the next order of business? Do you stop prosecuting the drug dealers, the child molesters, the lone wolf ISIS acolytes? You're still going to prosecute them, right? Does Kash Patel have ideas about prosecuting them? Will the top deputies just do the prosecution after Kash made his point that we'll no longer be prosecuting the president? Unclear. And during his hearings, uncared about. But still, Republicans can console themselves that the FBI will essentially continue apace. Now, Tulsi Gabbard, head of intelligence, director of national intelligence, a little bit of a different story. She seems Assad curious, or was, once there was an Assad in Syria. She seems Putin receptive, but guess what? So is the guy who's giving the party its marching orders. There are a couple of Republicans who are genuinely anti-Russian in their bones, and they're really worried about Putin. But I guess they think that Tulsi won't really cook the books to carry a borscht flavor. Maybe they think she'll be more or less sensible. Maybe they say to themselves, you know, there was a branding opportunity in the last few years as an America first anti-imperialist. She took it. So they count her as an opportunist, not an ideologue, not a member of the fifth column. And they figure the cost of crossing Trump are more than the benefits of voting against Gabbard. And you know, this is maybe how their thinking goes, Gabbard was an officer in the army. She handled sensitive material capably. She was a Democratic congresswoman. She served on the Armed Services Committee. And then in her last term on the Intel Subcommittee, she had all the clearances then. She was given highly sensitive material when she was a Democrat, then we trusted her. Now, the Republicans may think, why not extend that attitude now that she's one of us? And even if not, this is again how their thinking may go. The CIA, the intel services, they're going to find a way to get the right info to the right people. They are professionals. They're secretive professionals, in fact. They can sneak the right info out. They can squirrel it away. They can spirit it away. All the S words. But that's their job. They could do it. What I'm saying is, on this one, on Gabbard, some of the Republicans who might have had misgivings actually are trusting the deep state. They think the intelligence community will find a way. And then with Patel, they think the domestic intelligence community will fall in line. He will be a bulwark against the deep state. Anyway, I'm not a Republican senator. I do not have to work overtime to explain their reasoning or motivation. What it basically comes down to is Trump's the president. All power flows through Trump. Let's give him what he wants. But then I start thinking about RFK Jr. It's fun to think about. Senator Bill Cassidy, Dr. Bill Cassidy from Louisiana, Republican, seemed to raise a lot of legitimate questions during the RFK Jr. confirmation hearing, and then Bill Cassidy voted for RFK. The Wall Street Journal opposed RFK's nomination also for lots of good reasons. RFK has the potential to make a lot of money from his official position as director of HHS. He promised to give the money to his son, so that's not corrupt. Tulsi said she would transfer her holdings to her husband. So again, nothing to worry about there. I know someone right now is screaming, Joe Biden, he might not have, quote, benefited from Ukrainian corruption, but his son did. So I get it. The turnabout is fair play logic. But on RFK, the Republicans also have made turnabouts on abortion, turnabouts on their longstanding support for agribusiness, RFK's organizations, River Keepers and his other nonprofit, quote unquote, organizations have sued many, many companies that have given many, many contributions to Republicans. But alone among these three nominees, I just do not see how Republicans do not see how this can go very, very wrong. Not for someone else, not for others, not even just for Trump, for them, because they voted for RFK. Name one reason not to vote for RFK. I could name more than one. I could name H5N1, avian flu, now in humans. Latest update, 69 human cases reported in 12 states. But officials say public health risk is still low. And how are they going to cure it? Well, apparently cutting out seed oil does the job. The real answer is vaccines. Vaccines help. There are vaccines against the avian flu. They have to get better. They have to address all the mutations. Who makes these vaccines? In the case of avian flu, it's GlaxoSmithKline in collaboration with CureVac, but also Moderna, Pfizer. Those are the big ones. They're working on an mRNA cure, by the way. Wow. Having RFK oversee the process where Moderna and Pfizer works on an mRNA cure, it's a little like hiring Kanye West to be a docent in the Holocaust Museum. Maybe to stick in the cabinet, it's like putting Pete Hegseth in charge of battleship christening sparkling wine procurement. This can't go well. Beyond RFK's ignorance about Medicaid and Medicare, during his confirmation hearings, he said Medicaid was fully funded by the federal government and that Medicare is a fee-for-service program. But okay, he could learn on those things. On vaccines, though, he already has learned, and they're almost all the wrong lessons. The director of HHS has to have a very well thought out vaccine policy. The questions are how to develop them, how to procure them, how to distribute them. Their stance, the HHS secretary's stance on vaccines, it's a little like the Secretary of Defense's stance on weaponry. Which ones? How much? The best values? The worst risks? RFK Jr.'s stance on vaccines is anti. Don't believe him when he says, well, I'm pro-vaccine, but it's like the bar in the Blues Brothers when it said, we play both kinds of music, country and Western. I'm sure there are two vaccines that RFK would give his kids, just not, and he says he has. He just hasn't given them or recommended that other people who need vaccines give them to their children so their children won't die. It's like the Amish guy who says, oh yeah, I'm into the latest technology, zippers, butter churns, all the cutting edge stuff. RFK at every turn discourages vaccine uptake. And there's not an anti-vaccine movement or moment that he doesn't affiliate himself with. I am not aware that he has ever criticized anyone who is anti-vaccine. Having him be the primary liaison between Moderna and Pfizer is crazy. Now, you might not know this. Moderna and Pfizer were pretty important in the fight against COVID-19. How important? Well, in 2021, their vaccine saved 14 million lives worldwide. That's the low figure. The high puts it in above 20 million. Of course, a lot of those figures come from the World Health Organization, which we've withdrawn from. So that's a great thing. Maybe the Republicans will say, RFK raises some great points about processed food. Or maybe they look at the Make America Healthy Again voter and say, I have to court her. But my God, if I were a Republican senator, I would not be able to hear any of my own thoughts above the ticking time bomb that is RFK in charge of HHS. Are we just going to have no public health emergencies that require someone with knowledge, or at least someone who doesn't have a lifelong hatred of the exact companies that history shows we are extremely reliant upon to live. You wouldn't select a Secretary of Defense who is on record as loathing Lockheed Martin and Northrop Grumman. You wouldn't appoint a Treasury Secretary who has for decades been locked in a battle to the death with Citibank and Goldman Sachs. I mean, such people are out there. An extremely radical left-wing president could appoint such a person as Treasury Secretary, but it would be insane to do so. I'll be fair. You might appoint a Secretary of Education who hates Houghton Mifflin and Scholastic. Little Clifford is a lovable red dog, and the stakes are a little lower there. We're talking about HHS. Millions could die. RFK running it is a bad, bad idea. I don't see what the Republicans see or aren't seeing. But have at it, guys. I'm sure all the senators who confirmed him are just hoping for the best, with fingers crossed and huge personal stockpiles of Cipro, and maybe, I don't know, a faith in the antioxidant properties of blueberries to get them through the next pandemic. That's it for today's show. Corey Wara produces The Gist. Michelle Pesca is the CBSO of Peachfish Productions. Upuru, Jipuru, Dupuru. Thanks for listening.